Welcome, everybody, to The Rad Life, the only talk radio show that takes you along with host and age explorer Rod Gontos on his continuing journey of discovery into life's challenges, opportunities, options, and all the latest and greatest things that come with getting older. The Rad Life is brought to you this week by Your Home for a Lifetime, a company dedicated to empowering you to stay safely, independently, and comfortably in your own home. And now here is your host, Rad Gontos.
Rad Gontos.
Hey, I was too busy here talking to our guest that I forgot that we were actually on the air. It happens sometimes. So anyway, boy.
You got a great guest today.
Boy, we got a great guest. And it's somebody that actually has been on the show before.
Yes.
Hey, thanks for coming back.
And you know,
we didn't scare him away.
He said it's kind of deja vu because we started late on that show, too.
It is a pleasure.
Well, hey, we're consistent.
Actually, no, so it's a pleasure to be back. No, I think last time you called in from the car. And then made a seamless transfer when you were walking me off.
We got to get your guest a little closer, though. He's too laid back for. He's in California.
He actually gave me a kudos for seamless transfer. Yeah, that's only because I got a lot of practice on it.
After subtly insulting you there.
Wow. I was going to try to paint him in the best possible way.
I don't think this is starting out well. Let's reset here.
Okay. Anyway, so my guest today on the show, on The Rad Life, is, and thank you for being here, Josh. It's nice to have you back.
It is a pleasure to be back.
Senator Josh Newman, representing Senate District 29. And actually, I think a happy anniversary is probably in order, right?
That you are absolutely right. So yesterday was the anniversary of my election actually being called because it was so close. It was 28th, and the election day was on the 8th.
Right.
It took 20 days of counting votes to actually make a determination.
How close was it?
It was less than 1% out of a total of 300, I think, give or take 15,000 votes. I won by a total of 2,600 votes, which is less than 1%. But what was really interesting and anxiety-provoking was on election night, I was actually down 3,900 votes when they stopped counting on November 8th.
Yeah, I remember this.
And then over the next 20 days, they counted votes across the three counties, and it wound up turning in my favor, and I won by
So for those who don't understand that process, when it's that close, there is a count that happens. And then who ratifies that count?
So there are when it's not close.
There was contention, right?
Well, the contention, you know, the people thought it was a recount. It wasn't a recount. There's a count. So, you know, what happens when you vote in a California Senate district is very large. So I have 16 different cities across the county. So there's three different county registrars.
What are the cities in District 29?
Well, so there's, you know, going from Northern Orange County, from Cypress up through La Palma, Buena Park, La Habra, Anaheim. Let's see, where else? My city of Fullerton, Placentia, La Habra. And then it goes up into southeastern LA County, up from Walnut, Diamond Bar, Roland Heights, a little bit of city industry, a little bit of about a quarter of West Covina, and then in San Bernardino County, the city of Chino Hills.
Wow.
So all in, you've got people voting for all the different stuff you vote for, different overlays, you're voting for Congress, you're voting for president. So when they count all the votes, it's easy to count those initial increments. But with the difference in my vote was those votes that got counted last. And so those are the last minute absentee votes where somebody sends it in late, it either arrives late or arrives by hand, or provisional votes where somebody went and voted somewhere other than their regular polling station.
Sure.
So when those votes got counted, that accounted for the switch, the differential.
Well, let me ask you this just in general. Would you say that when it comes to voting these days, it's getting to the point where this is not an unusual situation, where it's pretty close in some areas between candidates, and the reason why I'm asking this, Josh, is because my feeling is that we are actually experiencing a very interesting shift in the voter base as far as affiliation to party, as far as what is basically causing people to come out and actually vote.
Right.
And it almost seems that people are more engaged on issue-based voting than just pure party loyalty or what camp they begin in. And now, having said that, that may have something to do with the fact that we have a growth in sort of that independent, non-declared as a voter base. Not saying that they may not lean conservative or liberal or wherever on the spectrum, but it seems to me that that those who are really engaged in it, that are beyond sort of just this sort of blind party loyalty, whichever way it may fall, are actually engaged on it on the topics. And they're actually taking the time to delve into it. Now, they may have a biased intake on those topics, but it seems to me like the voter base, especially where we are in Southern California, seems to be more and more shifting into that. Would you agree with
that? I think that's true, especially insofar as if you look at the registrations. In my district, you know, it's about even between Democrats and Republicans. So, you know, it's actually when I started running, there was 1% more Republicans mm-hmm. than Democrats. But now it's flipped just because of some demographic changes.
Sure.
But it's about 35% Democrats, 34% Republican. Right. But that means the remainder
yeah.
are, as you noted, are no party preference or declining yeah. state voters. And they, you know, have made, in many cases, a conscious decision mm-hmm. to re-register from one party or the other because they're tired of a certain kind of party politics. And what they're looking for is either based on issues or some other basis for choosing better people.
Right. And I think, I mean, I live in South County, right, which for years and years and years, you know, decades has been considered basically a done deal as far as a conservative base down south. And those percentages that you just uttered reflect even down there. I think it's a very interesting thing that's happening where people are, which, you know, hopefully that means that we have more options in terms of who we vote for, more people willing to engage in civic service in the future. If it's based on talk, especially if it's local, we say it on the radio station all the time that all news is local news, basically, right?
Right.
So I just wanted to get your take on that. And yeah,
can I disagree for one second though? Nationwide, there's only of the 435 congressional seats. I think there's only about 10% of them that are considered competitive. I think it's something meaning that to your point, more people are less party preference, but they've skewed these things through gerrymandering, both left and right, so that the districts are overwhelmingly one or the other. And very, very few of these districts are competitive or in play
so
anymore.
Let me add and relate that to the state, you know, sort of offices. So, you know, my race, I think, got a lot of attention because mine was so close. And the seat I hold, I'm a Democrat, but I'm a kind of a centrist. But the seat I hold had been a Republican-held seat for basically forever, about 40 years.
Right.
And so
you're running against an incumbent, I believe.
Well, not really. No. So, the incumbent was termed out. Senator Bob Huff was termed out. I was running against a sitting assembly person, you know, from there's two assembly districts within a state Senate district, who is a Republican. And so because it was so close, it wound up getting a lot of attention because it was called so late. And it was the difference between Democrats in California having a supermajority in both houses.
Right. It affected a supermajority in the houses.
But the difference probably with respect to federal races is California doesn't. Well, one, we don't use partisan bases for districting, right? Sure. So we have this nonpartisan commission-based system, and it has made a difference. But we also have the top two primary, which is makes a difference in that you know anybody can run, and then the top two finishers run against each other in the general. So
they could be from the same party, even.
And in many cases, lately they are.
Yeah.
And so if it's really disproportionate, you know, around registration, you're going to probably get two Democrats statewide offices. You see that. In mind, you're probably going to get one of each. But what you then have is everybody gets to vote in the primary mm-hmm. for anybody and anybody. And so, you know, you do get, I think, a different kind of traction.
But to answer Paul's question, Paul, that may be what it is on a nationwide level. But I actually believe there is a paradigm shift that's happening, and it's for a whole number of reasons, some of them positive, some of them very reactionary. But there's definitely a paradigm shift. You cannot say to me that election cycles in the foreseeable future and going forward can be played out based on the playbook of previous elections. There's been a paradigm shift in how people are looking at topics, how people are weighing on stuff, and their willingness to actually abandon party affiliation, even though they may lean one way or the other, but to say, no, I am not a taken for granted that I'm going to vote one way
or
the other.
So I will agree mostly, Rad. What I think you see is on either side, partisans on either side are getting more partisan, you know, sort of on both ends of the spectrum. But it's in the middle where there's a sizable number of people, I think growing, who are just frustrated with
feeling
that,
not really represented.
Yeah, and just like that process doesn't work for them. And, you know, I think, and so what you see in terms of changes in registration numbers, that's you see Republican voters tend to be older. And so new voters registering, if they're immigrants, you know, or new arrivals mm-hmm. or young people, they're more likely to register Democrat than Republican. But people are much more likely today than they were 10 years ago to register as independents. particularly where in California, that doesn't restrict them from voting in primaries.
Right. We had Neil Kelly. In other states, it does.
We had Neil Kelly in here some time ago, and I was shocked to learn that in what is considered to be Republican Orange County, historically, is not that way anymore. And the largest group of registered voters are not Republicans or Democrats in this country, county. It's declined to state, that independent third wave that Wave is talking about. So that's certainly grown here. But having said that, California in a whole is now another one of these states where we have a supermajority. It's one party in complete dominance of every office from top to bottom. So, Texas, it's the opposite. It's the Republicans. Here, it's the Democrats.
So let me ask you this, Josh. You've been in there for a year. You've been very busy with bills this year. I mean, I think what's the final count? I had something.
So I had
11 bills.
I had 11 bills that I authored that were passed and signed.
You're supposed to just sit quiet for the first year and learn where the bathrooms are.
Think how many bills I would have gotten if I weren't doing that.
So to that point, how has it been? I mean, being now on the inside versus trying to get in. Now you're here. Any insight? How's this year been?
So we're going to get to kind of the elephant in the room topic. I can say, you know, despite that challenge, we'll get to it. It's been immensely rewarding. I'm not a politician by, you know, training or even by temperament. So, you know, I ran as a novice to this because I thought, as you know, as we've been discussing with independents, I'm a Democrat, but I really did feel strongly that people deserve better than they're getting from their public officials, from their elected officials.
Amen.
And so in my race, there were three of us. Mm-hmm. And I will say the other two, I was not impressed. I would not have voted for either of them. And I was struck by the fact that there's give or take a million people in a state Senate district. And it should be in a state as rich in talent as California. We should have immensely talented people competing to be the final two, you know, candidates in the general. And we often don't see that. And we haven't talked about that. And that's related to how expensive politics is
and ugly.
Exactly. And to the extent to which smart people, talented people have opted out because they can do other things that are not nearly as expensive, either in terms of money or
painful.
Putting their loved ones through it. I mean, it can get really nasty.
Can I just stop for one second?
Hold on. To that point, though, Josh, I do want to say thank you because you're absolutely correct. I mean, the initial natural reaction is one of flight in a situation like this. And yet there are those, and I want to give credit to all of them, that actually still step up and still actually put themselves in that position to try to be of service. And that is not a small thing these days because it is a nasty business. It is an expensive business. It can get really dirty. And it's not just you that you have to think of. It's all everybody else, your family, your loved ones.
You don't really, I mean, I appreciate what you're saying. You don't know that until you do it.
Yeah.
And so my wife is an idealist by nature, but we have this kind of funny conversation that goes on where she has kind of an observation, a question. The observation is always ironic, which is like, oh, now we know why good people don't want to be involved.
Oh, now we get it.
And then the question is always, you know, do you still think it's worth it?
Right.
And I do think it's worth it because to your point, I mean, if everybody good opts out, you kind of get what you deserve. And, you know, I don't think it's a coincidence. Last time I was here, it was before I ran, it's because I'd been working on veterans issues.
Sure.
And I think you and I were talking about it. There was a job fair that I was involved in. And you know, that was kind of the insight that I worked, and I hadn't planned on running for anything, but I wound up kind of working because I'm a vet, trying to find better ways to
serve. Yeah, you're trying to transition veterans into
And work. I wound up having a lot of interactions with first state programs, but then elected officials, and it occurred to me that, wow, like, you know, everybody says the right things but doesn't do anything. And if we as a state, as a society, for that matter, we, you know, always say the right things but don't do what we say we will for veterans, you know, where we agree that they deserve much better than they're getting, what are the odds that we're going to do the harder things, you know, on other issues?
Exactly. You think that is a topic that everybody can come together on, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think, you know, that was kind of the insight. And that's where I thought, you know what, I think I have something to offer. And so, to your question, it's been, you know, fascinating and rewarding on some level. It's been frustrating and challenging on some others, but I wouldn't change it.
Well, Paul's got a question. I want to ask you, just think about what are some of the highlights really quick and what are some of the low points in this first year? Go ahead, Paul.
Just wanted to point out that in this state, a Senate district has a million people in it. That's more than are represented in some states.
Yeah, I think the number is six states have fewer, smaller populations than a state senate district in California, which is kind of astounding. I was telling Paul when I came in, I was at a conference a couple weeks ago, and there was a state senator from Mississippi there. Mm-hmm. And he said, wow, you've got about 1 million people. I've got 55,000 in my state senate district.
And so, exactly.
So, you know, California has some advantages and some great attributes because it's a huge state, but also mm-hmm. some big challenges. Mm-hmm. And if we, you know, there's only 40 members of the state Senate, mm-hmm. there's 80 assembly people, and we got a population of nearly 40 million. So we have every right to expect those 120 people to be talented people mm-hmm. and to be ethical people and be hardworking people.
So what are some of the highlights in the last year? And what are some of the low points?
So legislatively, I'll start with that. So, you know, very satisfying to get some good work done. First for veterans, got some money for veteran resource centers in community colleges to ensure that any vet, when they come home, they go to any of the 114 schools, that they get some basic, you know, baseline support to ensure that they'll get off mm-hmm. On the right foot in their next chapter. Got some money for public safety for a pilot program in Orange County on an 8-city basis to find better solutions to homeless intervention, to gang prevention. So mm-hmm. that's very satisfying.
A big issue in Orange County.
Oh, yeah. You know, a problem that has defied easy solutions. Mm-hmm. And the challenge is you can't solve these problems at the state level, and it's awfully hard to do at the municipal level.
Oh, we were talking about people before the show started. We were talking about how sometimes there's a perpetuated sort of invitation to continue a denial, being in a bubble. And I think those issues of the homelessness and poverty in places that are affluent like Orange County, there's a certain amount of bury your head in the sand and it's not my issue, not my backyard, push it off to somebody else. But unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, we cannot do that anymore. And we should be facing these issues. We should be addressing
these things. You mean we just can't round them up and ship them to the next city?
Well, and that's, sadly, Paul, that is some of the stuff that I hear from very intelligent people that feel like not in my own backyard. And yet, I've mentioned this before, and I will mention it again. Where I live in San Clemente, the city of San Clemente, I apologize to any council members that I know, but it really was kind of a little foolish to try to play fast and loose with the state law about basically zoning an area for a homeless shelter. And what ended up happening is they got their wrists slapped, and that was fast and loose with my taxpayer money. But basically they got their hands slapped, and we couldn't approve any projects, one of which was we've been waiting for over 10 years to get a preservation or adaptive reuse on a historical theater down there, because until they would basically fulfill the requirement based on state law, the court says you cannot issue any permits on anything. Mm-hmm. So we ended up having to go back. But there was a waste of time. There was a denial. There was, in a certain way, a misguided leadership situation there. And unfortunately, countywide, I think when it comes to the homeless issue, when it comes to poverty, child poverty, you know, maybe even with veterans issues, sometimes we are very lacking.
Well, you know, and everybody.
So thanks for that.
Being lacking.
thanks for having a pilot program. I mean, at least to do something to maybe try to get a better result from what we've had.
Right.
I'm a pragmatist by nature, and so it has been.
That's
satisfying.
An ugly word these days.
I know. And centrist is also an ugly word. but it's to your question. So you know those things are great. That, you know, in terms of other legislation, I think some good work on behalf of vets, public safety, mental health parity, some other things. To the question about the challenges. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of work, right? Not that I'm complaining, but it turns out it's not a particularly glamorous job if you do it well and you do it
right.
I'm
sure you get a lot of pushback too.
And then the biggest kind of challenge for me, the biggest kind of learning experience, I guess, in my relatively short time in politics was back in April, we as a legislature voted on the obvious question about how do we fix California's crumbling infrastructure? Mm-hmm. And so I was one of 27 senators who voted. There are 54 or 55 in the assembly who voted to approve a suite of pay-as-you-go taxes to fund improvements to our roads, our bridges, or other transportation infrastructure, and then moderate increases to the gas excise tax, to the diesel tax, a slight increase in the cost of registering a vehicle, then phased in for electric vehicles in 2020, and then the aftermath of that, for reasons we've already discussed, because my election was very close, mm-hmm. and I hold a seat that's kind of been viewed as a Republican seat. I became the target of this very intense recall.
I remember not that long ago when Gray Davis, one of the claims against him is he raised the vehicle registration fee. And that was one of the things that he got crucified over.
Get to that, let me ask this question. Okay, we're the sixth largest economy in the world. We are considered to have be the bastion of innovation and up to speed on stuff and so forth. Let's just address this issue about a failing infrastructure or a need for revitalization of infrastructure, right? Why isn't this something? I'm going to play dumb, right? Isn't this something that is happening all the time? Aren't my tax dollars going towards stuff like that?
Well, I think you know the answer to that. Right,
but I'm asking.
So, but the answer is actually yes and no. So, of course, your tax dollars are going somewhere, and they're not all being stolen. They're not all being misspent. But this is a giant state where we as a state, as kind of, a quasi-economy, have set a bunch of priorities that turn out to be fairly expensive. So, California has a greater level of social services than most states, but that costs money. And over time, especially with the recent recession and a bunch of cutbacks and, mm-hmm. and priorities that had been made, we as a state neglected those investments, which, other countries take for granted, in our infrastructure, in our roads, our bridges, in things like the dams, Orville Dam, things like that. And you wind up with an aggregation of, $130 billion of deferred maintenance over that time. So that sounds theoretical until you have a bridge collapse in Monterey County during the recent rainy seasons, until it starts to cost much more. I mean, it's not different than
maintaining
car.
Infrastructure. Don't get me wrong, Josh. I mean, maintaining infrastructure is, if anybody watched a bit of news this year and looked at all the impacts of the hurricanes, looked at all the flooding that happened, going back to even New Orleans and the levees not being up to snuff, right? I mean, this is a serious thing that we have to make a priority. However, my point to you is, when I hear the reaction to that being passed, the reaction is as if there is an alternative.
Well, that was the wild thing to me. So, what was the alternative? And so, there were a couple members that...
It's called kick it down the road.
Kicking the can was the alternative. But we had done that for 20 years, and we were seeing the fruits of that neglect. And so I hadn't been there for 20 years. And so the only analogy I could think of is as we were... presented with that not particularly attractive notion of raising people's taxes, but was it necessary? The answer, I think, was yes. And the analogy I used was, if you were elected to the board of your HOA and you found out that your predecessors for the previous 20 years had neglected the property, what would you do? Well, you have a responsibility. Yeah, of course you would. You'd repair the property.
Right? Or you'd dip into your...
And everybody scream off at your head.
You'd dip into your reserves if necessary. You'd probably have to raise your homeowner's dues. Right. But then what you would also do is you'd make sure
But you can't deplete your reserves either because ends up being at least a combination of two.
Of course. Right. But, again, just using that simple analogy, you would also make it clear to your constituents that you're going to do this transparently and accountably. And then when it was done, you'd revert back to some better basis. So, what is the legislature if not kind of... the state's HOA.
Yeah, but nobody reverts to anything, Josh.
Well,
money. I mean,
that's the truth.
We say that.
That's the feeling.
And the problem, with infrastructure is it's not sexy, right? And so, in any given year, we made choices that led to the neglect. Mm-hmm. But then you get to a point where you can't anymore, and then what the proof is that industry.
I was going to say. The toll roads aren't coming back.
I will say in other states, Red, you have toll roads that were they were phased out deliberately. That was the way we paid for the freeway systems, on the East Coast and other places.
Right.
But, that's a philosophy or government thing, which is, is that how we want to run our government, our infrastructure? And it's sort of a
saying, and it's sort of a tongue in cheek, is that when we say it's transparent, that tends to be transparent until a certain point.
Well, I'm saying it should be.
It should be transparent.
I'm saying it should be transparent. So, as a member of the legislature,
and it shouldn't be permanent, such as in the case of when we needed to build roads and we set up a joint powers agency called the TCA, and we basically had a representative from every city. The plan was to build roads, to pay them off, pay the bonds off, and then return to public use. And the way it has materialized is that wasn't the case.
Ain't gonna happen.
It doesn't have to be that way.
Right.
And we've allowed it to be that way. And one of the reasons we've allowed that to happen is because we haven't been more disciplined and more forthright with the voters about how we'll pay for infrastructure.
So how is this different?
Well, this is a different one because it was necessary. But I you know, I'll say my contribution wasn't just the vote, mm-hmm. right? I was one of 81 members who voted for it. My contribution was actually a constitutional amendment that was done on the same day in parallel, that if it'll go to the voters in June, that if it passes, it'll amend our Constitution to ensure that none of that money that will be raised through SB 1, through these new taxes, can be diverted for any other reason.
What? That's the old shell game. You raise it from one thing, you spend it on something else.
Well, you know, that's not how it should work. And I do think that voters and citizens deserve the assurance that if you're going to pay your hard-earned tax dollar to the government, that you should get full value for it.
So is this amendment that goes to the voters, is this specifically for SB 1?
Yes.
Okay.
So SB 1 created a couple new revenue streams, and so it'll make clear by amending the Constitution that these monies can only be spent for the appropriate uses, and that's transportation and the infrastructure.
But didn't we do some of that for education and stuff too?
So what happens if it doesn't pass? If the amendment doesn't pass, do we have a bill that passed?
Right. No, we'll still raise the funds, but it's not as secure.
Okay.
Right. And so, you know, some people have said to me, like, well, why do we have to do that in the first place? Why can't we trust you? I don't have an easy answer for that. You should be able to trust the government, the people who you elect to run it. But it's, again, big state, lots of competing priorities, things mm-hmm. change. And you know, a 1% change in direction in a big state like this is a lot of money.
But you try to put in to play something that would try to manage and ensure as much as possible that to happen,
sure.
And you're putting it out to the people to actually decide whether that's something
right. And you know, and okay. that's kind of the essence of, right. of representative democracy, right. participatory right. Democracy. So, you know, as an example, you know, a lot of people have concerns about the funding for the high speed rail, the bullet train.
Sure.
And so there's a perception that this, you know, the rise in these transportation taxes will somehow get
reused projects, yeah.
and will go to, for instance, to the train. And so, right. and that won't legally be possible. Now, you know, can you stop people from doing unethical things? No,
but at least you have recourse.
Of course.
If this passes. Yeah. Okay, so you said that 80 people voted for this.
81.
81 people.
Me and 80 others.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was it voted on along party lines?
Well, you know, that's the irony. So it was, yes, with one little exception. So in the assembly, where to raise taxes in California by, you know, the virtue of the Constitution, you have to have a two-thirds vote. So two-thirds of 80 is 54 in the assembly, and that was all Democrats. Two-thirds of 40 in the Senate is 27. And that as it turned out, there were only 26 Democrats. Mm-hmm. The 27th Democrat had made one of these, I'll never raise taxes pledges. So he didn't vote for it. So it was actually a Republican from the Central Valley who got the Senate to 27. Mm-hmm. And yet I became the target of this recall effort. Because it's really more of a pretext than anything.
If I was to target a point where, you know, now that there's a supermajority, mm-hmm. and regardless of where, just for the sake of winning, basically, I would basically look at something that, like in your case, was very close.
Sure.
It had a lot of visibility in how close it was. And then you are one of the 81 people. So basically, I'm going to go after you because that's a recent story of where, you know, you shifted.
Oh, and believe me, I understand the logic. But if you think about if you make a distinction in public service and politics,
right.
that's the politics.
Right.
On the public service side, you know, I'd like to think I'm a good, diligent public servant. But, you know, so the argument, you know, to throw me out was that I voted the same as 80 other people. Doesn't make a lot of sense unless you're honest that it's just purely partisan politics.
But you said 27 Democrats, right?
No, 26 plus
26
one.
Plus one.
In the Senate.
In the Senate.
In the Senate. Okay. Yeah. Right.
81 but, overall in both bodies.
Right. Okay. So 54 in the Assembly.
So was it heavily Democrat?
Well, sure. 26 out of 27.
No. My point on this is this. You're talking about infrastructure needs. Are you telling me that based on party politics, one side of the aisle basically had no interest in basically supporting infrastructure?
I suppose, right, you could infer that. So only one Republican out of, you know, the remainder, which is, you know, there's 13. And so the other 12 voted no.
So here's
they voted no to fixing California's infrastructure.
Here's how I'm wired.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm a solution provider by nature. Okay. And what I do, and every day when I encounter a situation, you identify that the legitimacy of the situation, And then you don't bury your head in your sand, and you face it, and you try to figure out a way to actually resolve
it. My friend, you would be just as bad a politician as me.
I know. But as a voter, I'm trying to understand, if we actually have a quantifiable issue with infrastructure in the state of California, and we need to address the need to take care of that, right, that the alternative to not finding a vehicle by which to do this, wherever it may be, okay, reallocating stuff, putting out new tax, whatever may be that mix of things, right? If I am actually not working diligently to deal with the issue of infrastructure rebuilding, then I basically am being completely irresponsible.
But the Republican position would
be... And if that's based on party lines, race taxes, then give me an alternative.
The alternative would be to slash services. They want to slash all these services.
Well, but
you already got enough money.
That is
spend
fine.
It somewhere else.
That is fine if you present a plan and we can argue about that plan. There, in the case of this,
it's exactly
this bill,
where I was going with.
There was no alternative presented other than, as we see these days, is somebody's got a plan, they're going to bring it. So don't vote on this now. So, we've been doing that for 20 years.
But politics in this country has shifted from actually being an active participant in solution provision. It is enough, it seems, for people on both sides of the aisle to say, no, I'm just going to vote against what they want.
Oh, sure.
But not really spend the time. I hate to put it this way, but when you basically scream bloody murder for 7 years about repeal and replacing of something, and you don't have a plan in place the day one that you basically now have a majority, what the heck were you doing for the last 7 years as a representative of the people?
You never wanted to replace it.
And I think that analogy is a good one. I think that's true with respect to infrastructures. You want the credit that comes with protecting people's tax dollars, but you do not have a plan to solve the problem.
Right.
And you're not presenting an alternative.
Sure.
So all the energy, all the time, all the money, all the PR, all the marketing, all the targeting is done to do what? To discredit one side without offering an alternative.
But it works.
You have just described politics in a nutshell.
It works.
It works.
But it works. And that is why people are abandoning both parties.
And it works because we've allowed it to work. People are abandoning both parties, but hopefully they're doing something else, which is getting smarter, and hopefully some good people get involved. And for me, I happen to be a Democrat. The irony of my situation is I'm probably the least ideological member of my Democratic caucus. But, we need more of that. We need more people who are problem solvers, like you said, than partisans, because that hasn't gotten us very far.
But the problem is that the center is evaporating. The Josh Newmans of the world are not being elected. Look at the number of moderate Republicans and moderate Democrats that have decided they're not going to run again.
But if you're a centrist, you're a
socialist.
I also think it's also true that not a lot of centrists run these days, right? Because you get your candidates from within the party, typically.
Right.
So I'm a bit of an exception in that, I was not the Democratic Party's choice when I decided to run in the primary. And you're never going to get centrists, despite the goals of this, the top two primary. That goal was to create a bigger space for moderates. But if the parties still decide who gets to run, you kind of get unsurprisingly
and
what you get.
And that is where the control is. That is where the problem with people who want to be of service, who want to run, who want to represent, who are driven by things that are not ideological extremes, have a hard time because it's pretty much sealed up.
Well, that's what you had Greg Rath on from the Republican side who tried to run for Congress.
He was a Clinton Republican, remember?
Right.
He was being accused of being a Clinton Republican because he was stationed at the White House under Clinton when
and
he
was
in the service.
And he wasn't picked. Mimi Walters was picked.
It's your turn or who gets picked. And if that's the contest within the contest is to get picked by your party, you're going to get more of the same all the time. And so this is a really difficult question. So term limits were, in theory, a solution. What that just gives you shorter durations for now the next person. Just
and musical chairs that go from one office to the next, right?
And people have said that because I'm all for term limits, okay? People say, well, but wait, hold on a second. Once a person gets in and then gets their feet wet and now they have a little bit of seasoning, then basically they're going to term out. And I'm like, you know what? Yeah. They go in, they serve, they basically give an opportunity for somebody else.
But I don't know that solved the problem, like he's saying. I don't know that it really does.
But if you define the problem a little bit differently, because I don't disagree with you, is about how do we ensure that you get good people during those terms? And one other thing that term limits has done is it's made consultants and staff more powerful, right? Because, mm-hmm. you know, they're the more knowledgeable.
But even if we don't get good people, ensure that we get good people every single time, Josh, when you have a higher likelihood of change, your chances are more likely that you're going to end up with somebody at some point in time that has a different attitude to way they're providing.
Why is that true, right? Because you could just get, you know, you'll get a Democrat just like the last Democrat or Republican just like the last Republican, especially in safe districts. Why is there any assurance that you're going to get different
You have other variables at play. You have generational variables at play. You have change in demographics at play. You have change in population makeup and matrices in play. And all that happens over time.
But tell me how
a person with a certain ideology today that basically has endless ability to sit in and is basically shored up by an infrastructure and a political system that ensures their reelection. From day one after they get elected, their whole driving reason for being there is to be reelected for next
year. I would say that's it's not inherent in the process. It's particular to the people. And there's a certain kind of person who becomes a politician. And, you know, most people aren't like me who get elected kind of out of nowhere at age 52. Most people have been on a city council and then, you know, this, that. And so they've learned a process and a set of rules and a sensibility. And so, you know, I would argue something kind of differently, which is in state government, especially, most of the things we work on should not be partisan.
Right? Absolutely.
So this question I think you framed it well about infrastructure. Like, why would that ever be a partisan? When it breaks down across partisan lines, you can be pretty sure it's not about the issue. It's about the politics. And, you know, that's true of most things that
it's
we
like
should
veterans
do.
Benefits. It's like it's like, right. I mean, these should be issues that we have no qualm what shirt color I'm wearing. We're right. all in it for the same
people
reason.
Said well, that's but that's the, clearly not true.
But that's clearly
days.
Not true.
Right.
Yeah.
And people
have
said that's the power of city politics, though, is that fixing potholes is not a political issue.
Oh, but I can tell you, in all the cities in my district, everybody knows, you know, that theoretically your city council member, you're nonpartisan.
Right.
You run as a nonpartisan.
Theoretically.
Everybody knows everybody's party relationship and everybody knows.
Well, and if it's nonpartisan, why do you get a central committee endorsement?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
So let me ask you two questions, and he's going to go. One is, so have you talk about term limits and other things and the top two contenders. Has any of this really changed the system, or have they just found a way to get the same people elected over and over and over again, same types of people, the same physical people? It seems like term limits didn't change anything because we still got the same politicians. They just swap offices more often.
So, I'm new to this, and I'm kind of naive and all that. But I would say you're not wrong, right? You know, I don't think the sensibility has changed much. It's just the cycles or the timelines probably have changed. And so there is a question about how do we in a state as big and as challenged as California just get better people who are working within the system so that we have a fair contest, that at the end of it, I don't care if it's a Republican or a Democrat, I want a smart person who cares, who will be responsive and accountable. And too often, I think you see elections where neither of those candidates mm-hmm. fits the description, so no surprise, we get more of the
so
same.
So how do we?
That's the second question.
So part of it is, and, you know, this is a whole other show, I think you have to take the money out of politics, say that the barriers to entry are lower. Mm-hmm. But there's a more subtle, more complex question. We have to ensure that more people are well-equipped with kind of the civic knowledge and the tools to participate so that they have strong opinions and a basis for getting involved at whatever level so that over time the people that you choose mm-hmm. from among to, you know, elect at the Assembly or State Senate. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're getting good people who are smart, who are civic-minded, and who are unafraid of doing difficult things.
Do we institute some sort of evaluation system other than just purely the voter basically endorsement, you know, every 4 years or you know, that basically says, oh, you've done a good job? Do we institute some sort of result-oriented? I mean, it happens in corporate America all the time, right?
You want a test or something?
No, some sort of result-oriented.
But, I mean, that's in theory what an election's about. An election really is – I mean, think about what voting really is.
Yeah, but you know what happens in a period of 4 years? I mean, a freaking disaster happens in a period of 4 years.
No, I appreciate
going
that.
Down
but,
a different
path. But I was always struck, but, you know, people talk about politics and it's, you know, there's all the games and the money. But what voting really is voting is the process by which we hire the people who represent us in the public sphere, right? Voting is hiring. And a reelection really is an evaluation, you know, if you think of it that way, of your performance. And your managers, in this case, are the people who hired you. They're the voters. But we have to ensure that that's the right discussion and that it's not, there aren't distractions. It's not all about your partisan relationships or, you know, or your pretext. And it should be about, did you get good work done? Did you represent the citizens of your district well and fairly? But part of that, like I said, I think the citizens have a role to play in holding you accountable. And the only way you do that is by being knowledgeable and involved.
Well, and hopefully that's happening more, because the reality on the citizenship side is that we get engaged every 4 years, in part not only because we're lazy over the course of the 4 years and only get engaged at one time in the 4 years. It's because they have other things that occupy them. There's other realities in their lives. And so
right, but you know, I would...
But I agree with you.
So we're all busy, but you as a citizen, you know, you were talking about responsibilities.
Absolutely.
Rights and responsibilities.
Yes.
You know, you have a right to do whatever you want. As a citizen, I would argue, you have a responsibility to stay informed and to hold the people who work for us in the public sphere
accountable.
So you
know what would help?
Dude, you're asking me to be responsible for my public official, and I basically all I want to do is try to figure out a way out of jury duty. I mean,
I've had people say to me, you know, you say to somebody, did you vote? And they say, I don't want to vote. I don't want to get jury duty. And then I always break the news to them. You also get it from the DNC.
Listen, as a person that is a naturalized citizen in the United States, okay, who have grown up and lived in other parts of the world, right, I will tell you, I take that very seriously. Okay, I am a citizen and I have rights, but I also have a personal accountability to myself in terms of what responsibility comes with those rights. And maybe it is because I have a reference point, a personal reference point of being elsewhere where I did not have those rights, that I take these very seriously.
I think that's important, and Americans as a whole should be reminded of that on a more regular basis, that we are a very fortunate people. Californians are very fortunate people. And with those fortunate circumstance comes responsibility. And too often people make choices, right? Mm-hmm. You don't have to mm-hmm. vote. And I'm always struck by, I meet people who are so much more knowledgeable about fantasy sports or the Kardashians or something. And at the same time, don't know anything about the civic mm-hmm. sphere, right? They don't even know that I'm their state senator, or that there's a difference between the state senate and the U.S. Senate. Mm-hmm. So that's alarming.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean,
you have the irony of, you know, new arrivals.
I got to be the responsible party.
No,
I got to be the responsible one in the thing. He's got
to
go.
No, I understand. So I just wanted to give you an opportunity, Josh, to give people the website and how they could basically communicate with you before you head out.
Oh, if you Google me, you'll get to either my state website page, you can see my legislation.
Josh Newman, 29th Senate District.
Right, that's what you would Google. Or NewmanForSenate.com is kind of the more political stuff, and you'll see how you can help.
So last question, what do you think about the recall? How do you think you're going to fare?
And when does it get decided?
So we don't know yet. It becomes more likely as time goes on that it'll be part of the next June election. How do I feel about it? It's sort of a crazy thing that you decide that, you know, you have something to offer and you run, you get elected, and the next thing you know, you're fighting to not be kicked out. And I find myself asking the question, like, you know, again, why? Like, if I voted the same as 80 others, and I'm the one person, sort of an odd experience, but...
Why you?
Poster child for
that. But I know why. It's, you know, it's because of the politics.
Yeah.
And so how do I feel about it? On the one hand, I think I've done my very best as a public representative. I think I've done some good work. So I'm not particularly concerned. I'm fairly confident that I will not be recalled. But I will say that, you know, if that happens, I'll find some other way to contribute. But I would say more generally, this is part and parcel of the politics that people have come to find very frustrating.
Unfortunately,
it's made people cynical.
Mm-hmm.
And the best way to push back on that is to defeat it, because it makes it less likely that the next good public servant will be targeted in this way.
Well, and they will think twice about even putting their foot into that pool. Listen, I think that's a perfect place for us to end. I appreciate you being here. I know you got to run. You're welcome at any time.
I will look forward to coming.
And you know what would help is if people are busy. We don't know what you guys know. We don't know what's on the table up there. And sometimes if you could come back to us, even if you just called in and said, here's an issue that the public needs to be aware of.
So I would absolutely, I'd be happy to do
that. Yeah.
And I will give you, I've got a couple minutes.
Yeah.
I'll give you an issue. So
sure.
I'm going to introduce a bill in the next legislative year, and no coincidence, and you'll see why, that would prohibit the use of paid signature gatherers to collect signatures for petitions. Right. So. You know,
you think you're being targeted now?
So, how can it get worse? Right? And so, you know, because clearly, like, you know, these processes are important. But when you pay people per signature, you create some very distorting incentives for there. You know, there are people that do this for a living.
Yeah.
They will say whatever
There's
it takes.
Big money in it.
Apparently.
Yeah.
And so in my case, I found out that the people collecting the signatures, and they weren't saying, like, let's get rid of Josh Newman. Mm-hmm. It's terrible. They were saying, hey, you want to repeal this gas tax, sign mm-hmm. here. Mm-hmm. They were being paid initially $3, and it went as high as $12 by the end to get to that threshold. And so some very large number of the people who signed.
For $12, I'll sign it.
For, yeah, totally. And, it, you know, you get 10 people, in, 10 people an hour, you're making way more money than I am, right? And so you know, by all means, hire people to collect signatures. But don't give them a perverse incentive to distort the truth, to lie to people as to what they're signing.
Which is very common, by the way. Right. I mean, the language is skewed. The way the sentences are presented, there's other underlying caveats in it, and sadly, that is the nature of our political system. That's the nature of how people get those signatures to put that recall on the ballot, and we all pay for that. We all suffer from that.
In many ways,
right?
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
We are already probably at the and every time I say this, then we get lower, right? Every time I think we've hit the lowest bottom possible, you know, as far as integrity, as far as when it comes
we
to...
We think we hit the bottom and then we get Trump.
And you know what? And you know what? And
yeah, really.
And you know what? There is a certain aspect of this, from a contrarian perspective, we get what we deserve.
Yeah. Well, you're the one saying... Sure. Only by going through
because
this
if
what
we're
we
not,
learn.
If we're not engaged, if we're not spending that time, I mean, just a simple example. If you went around and asked people, how many hours are you on Facebook every day?
Yeah.
How many hours do you actually
I'm
listen
on right
to
now.
News every day? Okay. How many channel variety do you actually listen to in order to basically formulate your own opinion? How much research do you do in something that impacts your pocketbook, impacts your life, okay, compared to how many hours of dumb, you know, or you know,
the Kardashians.
Mind-numbing
exactly.
TV do you watch?
Exactly.
Right? If you're a citizen of the United States, you have the responsibility to be involved in your own democracy. If you are basically counting on other people to do it, then you're only complaining every 4 years. You deserve what you get.
Fortunately, I only listen to OC Talk Radio, and that's all I need.
Well, that's all I'm listening to in the future as well.
And there is how we pay our bills, ladies and gentlemen. Right, Paul, Josh, thank you so much.
Hey, thank you guys.
Really.
For
and again, like I said, you're welcome anytime. I would love to have you come in regularly.
Let's do it. I look forward to it.
Even if it's a call, if you say, hey, here's something the people need to know about that's affecting you that you're not aware, it's not getting news, not getting coverage, but wake up. Something's happening.
I will gladly do that. I look forward to it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yep. Take care. I think we are going to be closing this episode. I think the only thing to say is get out there, get involved, find out for yourselves. Don't let anybody tell you what your thoughts and opinions should be. Thank you. And
keep listening to
OC Talk Radio. I purposely didn't put this out early about Josh being here because I really wanted this show to be very candid. I didn't want to have a lot of people calling in, and basically we end up in this tit-for-tat kind of fight back and forth. But having said that, if you're listening to this episode later, if you have any questions, go ahead and put them down on OC Talk Radio's page on Facebook or the Rad Life's page on Facebook. You can always email me, as long as it's not hate mail, at... Rod, R-A-A-D, period, Gantus, G-H-A-N-T-O-U-S, at gmail.com. I want to hear, you know, opposing opinions. I want to hear what your thoughts are. But at the end of the day, if we destroy the integrity of the political process in which we are all subject to, we all pay the price. Regardless of whether you're wearing a red shirt or a blue shirt, we all pay the price. And if you don't believe me, take a look at what is happening in terms of party loyalty and independent voter registration.
I'll throw in one thought. I just heard this the other day about Trump. Trump and the people and the movement he represents feels that conflict is the normal course of discussion, that anger and conflict, that we are in perpetual conflict with another. I win, you lose. Trump comes from that zero-sum world. I win, you lose. And we've lost this notion
win-win. That's what the quote-unquote performers on the stage are doing, Paul. Okay, there's another thing that's happening that is really infuriating, mm-hmm. okay? And that is that how we justify and defend that behavior is to say, and I'll use the recent example of Trump basically making a reference, at a celebration of Native American veterans.
Really?
To a person who wasn't even in the room, and the topic had nothing to do with the event. Okay, and basically,
just had the zinger
Senator,
one more time.
Senator Warren about Pocahontas, and then saying, "You guys are very special people." Okay, I mean,
in front of a picture of Andrew Jackson.
I don't know about you, and it's not an issue of party loyalty one way or the other. But I was embarrassed as an American that this is the representation that we have at the top office in the land. But here's where it really became a pain in my backside, is when that justification of that behavior, nobody talked about whether that was appropriate for the president to do or not appropriate on its own merits.
At that occasion, no. Right.
The response was, well, so you have a problem with the president, but you don't have a problem with Elizabeth Warren basically falsifying her, whatever it is, to Harvard about being of Native American descent. And my response was, wait a minute. When we were kids, that justification system approach that you just did is the equivalent of me going back home, and when my mom says to me, how come you broke that window? My response is, oh, well, but so-and-so broke the window too.
Right.
We all know how that worked out, right? It didn't cause mom to all of a sudden go,
Yeah.
You know, you are correct.
You're making a good point there.
You're making a good point there.
A little rod.
That didn't exactly happen, right? I probably have the marks to prove it. But I think we have become ridiculous. We've become ridiculous about justification. Based on what? Evaluate a situation based
tribes.
On its own merit.
But that's the whole nation. If we see ourselves as tribes in conflict with each other, we're going to fight forever. If we see ourselves as a group of people who have different, if we see us as a United States of America, then we will try and find the things that unite us. If we see us as tribes in constant conflict with each other, then this will never end.
You know, if this goes on, I'm telling you right now, somebody presents a piece of paper in front of me that says the state of California should secede from the Union.
We tried that a little while ago.
Yeah. I'll sign it.
Oh, my goodness.
Why should we be basically coming up short $15 billion every year or $13 billion every year as a donor state to the country?
To support all the rest of the states.
Yeah. And what are we getting for it? Lambasted as being the liberal elites of the West Coast? I mean, you start slinging shit. What's going to happen is only thing that's going to come back at you is the same equal venom.
But you don't realize.
And then
it.
You act offended because you're being attacked.
But again, you don't come from where I come
Regardless
from.
Regardless of party side, by the way, I'm not taking anybody out of
I put that on my Facebook face, kiddingly, when that was being floated right after Trump, there was a movement to secede, and it got a little steam and a little attention here in California. Didn't get much, but it got a lot of press. I put that on my Facebook fan page.
Mm.
All of my friends in the Midwest jumped on it immediately, said, go, good riddance, the hell with California, get out, we can't wait, you'll flop, you'll fail, we don't need you, we don't want you. And I was like, what are you saying? California is the engine of this whole economy here. We're one of the few bright spots in the whole economy, innovation and size.
You know what would happen?
You need us more than we need you.
You know what would happen? There would be troops on the border of Nevada, okay, with skirmishes that would start happening, okay?
But they literally said, you need us more than we need you. And I said, it's the opposite. This country relies on innovation centers and economic engines like California and New York, which is the irony that we're now going to get punished under the new tax bill if and when it goes through.
Hey, but at least we're not Puerto Rico, where we're going to basically get punished for 20% excise tax for anything that they ship out of there.
Because they voted against him, too.
I mean, like, this is insanity.
It's tribal politics,
and it's
worse.
And the saddest moment for me is when it's people that I know and that I've known for a long time, that I know individually, okay, that know that what drives me and motivates me is no bias one way or the other. I want a solution. I want the betterment for everybody.
Right.
Okay,
you're a businessman.
Right, that's it. Right. For them to justify a bad behavior by saying that somebody else did a bad behavior, supposedly, allegedly, that never worked when we were kids. And it
two wrongs
work
don't
right
make
now.
A right.
Two wrongs do not make a right. And if you don't believe me, ask your mother.
Yeah.
And on that note, thank you for joining us. We'll see you next week on Wednesday.
You have been listening to the Rad Life Radio Show with your host and age explorer, Rad Gontos, brought to you on the one and only OCTalkRadio.net. Join us again next week as we continue our journey of discovery into life's challenges, opportunities, options, and all the latest and greatest things that come with getting older.